This is Best of Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. With the city of Bloomington increasing the sales tax rate, a co-chair of the mayor's budget task force says, hold on, potential cuts haven't been given enough consideration.
We're kind of fast-forwarding right to the revenues without having time to discuss cuts and create a process that makes us accountable as a council for implementing those cuts.
David Sage and fellow task force member John Zunick talk about the next steps in addressing the city budget deficit. Plus, you'll hear from GLT's Judy Valente, traveling with a group of Central Illinois Catholics to see Pope Francis speak in Philadelphia this weekend, and a combination of science and cycling. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Best of Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT. With additional support from the Jack Batal Real Estate Group, more information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
This is Best of Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Excitement is still building as the visit of Pope Francis to the U.S. continues with a Mass in Philadelphia tomorrow. GLT's Judy Valente is on the way to Philly with a group of Catholics from Central Illinois. The trip began with the rising of the moon over Roanoke, Illinois. Valente tells us they're tired and excited after traveling all night. They're at 10 in a van for 12, and she says they saw the sunrise in Pennsylvania this morning.
It was lovely. The trip began last night with a blessing by the pastor of St. Joseph, Roanoke, Illinois, where a number of these parishioners attend church. And then as the sun came up this morning, the folks prayed the rosary. So the day began with prayer as well. And interestingly enough, they were able to get the Pope channel on Sirius Radio. So we were listening to reviewing everything that happened yesterday in Washington and New York with the Pope. So it's been a very prayerful, spiritual pilgrimage so far.
How do they approach the news and the mental preparation to put them in a spiritual frame of mind?
The folks on this pilgrimage have been praying for weeks now, both for the safety of the Pope, that his message will be absorbed in a very positive fashion. And I think that the folks on this pilgrimage are themselves absorbing the Pope's message. A word that keeps getting discussed among the group is mercy. Mercy, openness, you know, how to truly live out the gospel message. And I think that's what the Pope has been talking about for the past 2 days.
What are the backgrounds of the people on this trip?
Very varied. That's what's interesting. We have a young woman who attends DePaul University. She's traveling with her mother, who owns a gardening business in Roanoke. We have a hotel management person, a pediatric nurse, a retired nursing home assistant. Just a wide variety of people are on this trip. And one is a Catholic deacon, I might add.
Many Catholics are to the conservative side of the American political spectrum. The Pope has been issuing a rather more progressive message, citing Dorothy Day and Thomas Merton, than perhaps was initially expected. How is the message resonating with them?
Well, interestingly enough, I would say some of these folks, from what I gather from their conversation, might be a little bit more on the conservative political end on some issues. On other issues, they're very much, for example, for income equality and doing something about that in our country. And so I think that they are folks who hear the Pope's message, a message that some have labeled radical and leftist, but they find it very gospel-oriented. That's something they talked about this morning after the prayers, that his message is not left, it's not right, but it's gospel-oriented.
How does such a pilgrimage, such a ritual, situate itself in today's society?
Well, I think people are just happy to be able to go and share their faith publicly, together with other Catholics with the leader of their faith. That is something that doesn't happen for Catholics in America very often, unless, of course, they travel to Rome to see the Pope at the Vatican. It's a huge deal for these people to be among fellow Catholics. There's a great sense of gratitude for that. And one of the pilgrims said something as we were setting out last night. Catholicism has operated under a kind of a dark cloud for many, many years now. Some of it deserved and some of it not deserved. And this is an opportunity for them to celebrate the best of their faith, that message of mercy and compassion and inclusiveness that the Pope has tried to communicate.
Is the charismatic and emotional impact of a mass gathering, a huge public event, translatable to personal spiritual growth?
I think it will depend upon each individual. But I can tell you that I happened to be a reporter in Washington, D.C. when Pope John Paul II came in 1979, his first trip to the United States. And I was also sent to follow a group of people at that time. And then a year later, I checked back with them to do another story, a follow-up story. And, you know, one young couple had decided to have a child as a result of going to hear the Pope because he had talked about the importance of the family. You know, other people, it actually did change their lives. They changed jobs, things like that. So you don't really know how it's going to affect people. But I do believe that we're already sensing something is happening in our country. This message, particularly the message to Congress yesterday about appealing to our higher angels, I think the Pope was doing that in his message to Congress, and I think it is resonating already.
So it can then be more than just an emotional experience. It can be a touch point for self-reflection and charting a course forward.
I really think so, personally, and from what I'm hearing from the folks that I'm with. I think that no one will walk away from this visit without a greater sensitivity to those who are most marginalized in our society and wondering about, well, what can I personally do? The Pope has laid down a challenge about living the gospel in the 21st century, and what can I do to live that message out?
GLT's Judy Valente is on her way to Philadelphia to hear the Pope with a group of Central Illinois pilgrims. Thanks so much for talking with us, Judy.
My pleasure, Charlie.
And we'll hear a report from Judy next week on the event itself. She spoke to us from New Cumberland, Pennsylvania, about 90 miles away from Philadelphia. The group is from the combined parishes of St. Joseph in Roanoke and St. John in Benson and the parish of St. Mary in Metamora. Coming up in 11 minutes on Best of Sound Ideas, science and cycling.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial, featuring auto, home, life, and business insurance, plus retirement planning and more. Additional support comes from contributing listeners of GLT.
This is Best of Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. As one of the top blues harmonica players in the world, Chicago area native Bob Corator travels the world playing the music he learned to love as a teenager growing up in Wilmette. Now living in Phoenix, Corator also owns the Rhythm Room, a club specializing in blues and roots music. Corator also has a regular blues show on a Phoenix radio station and is an enthusiastic blues ambassador and historian. On this edition of GLT's Talkin' Blues, Corator talks to John Norton about hearing blues as a teen and the valuable lessons he learned by visiting his favorite blues artists on Chicago's tough West and South Sides.
You grew up in Chicago, and you've talked about how you heard blues on the radio, and it was almost like the first time you heard blues, it was sort of an aha moment for you. Would that be an accurate statement?
Absolutely. I heard Muddy Waters in the song Rolling Stone on a rock radio station. For the obvious reason, that's the song that the Rolling Stones named themselves after. But once I heard that, I heard everything that I loved about music condensed in that song. It was so perfect. It had all the raw guts and emotion. At the same time, it had a coolness and a toughness to it. From that moment on, Muddy Waters was my North Star.
Well, I wish I was a catfish. Swimming in a deep blue sea.
have all you good-looking women fishing after me, showing up after me, showing up after me. Oh, love, oh, love, showing up.
Was it something that you were thinking at that time, even, man, I got to be around this music, or I've got to be a part of this music? Or?
Well, I knew that I was headed in a direction of learning more about that music, and what would follow I could have never even dreamed of. So I've been able to, you know, live out so many dreams and play with some of the artists that I listened to before I would ever even dream of meeting them. And next thing you know, I'm cutting records with some of my favorite artists. I used to listen to Jimmy Rogers' Chicago Bound record. I dream about that record going to sleep. Years later, I would do a couple tours with Jimmy Rogers. We'd become good friends. I'd take him in the studio twice. Something like that is what dreams are made of.
The most recent release now is with the great Henry Gray. It's called Sessions Volume 1. It's some of the work you've done with Henry over the years. Next, I'd like to play a song from this album. Let's just do the very first track, Let's Get High.
Henry recorded this song in the 1950s, and it came out on a couple reissues. But it was from a session where Morris Pigeau, who was a partner of Henry Gray's, he was a guitar player and singer, he shared half the songs. So it mistakenly, and for years, was credited as Morris Pigeau's song. I knew it was Henry when I heard it. I'm like, that's you, Henry, isn't it? He goes, yep. And so we recreated that song in the studio and captured a lot of the feel of the original one. Just a rowdy party tune, and, you know, Henry's just having a blast with it. Willie Big Eye Smith and Bob Strozier are in the background shouting out answers to what Henry's singing. And, you know, it's just kind of just one of those fun, primal party blues numbers.
That's Henry Gray and our guest Bob Corritore here on GLT's Talkin' Blues. When you were going into those clubs as a young guy, and you would hang out at Teresa's, that legendary club where Junior Wells used to hold court, can you talk about what it was like to be in that scene, probably, what, the 1970s in Chicago?
Yeah, you know, when I was in high school, you could see some of the blues around there being underage. I mean, Blind Jim Brewer played at a pizza place not too far away from my house. Muddy Waters actually played in my high school gymnasium. We got to see Otis Rush at a nearby college in my community. There was the Hound Dog Taylor. There was a live recording session that actually became part of an album that I was at, that was at Northwestern University. You could go to Maxwell Street and see Big Walter Horton. There's things that were pretty unbelievable. And you could also go to some of the concerts. You go to a rock concert and they'd have Big Walter Horton and Carrie Bell opening up for John Mayall. And you go, no kidding. So these were some things that were very powerful, and they were all around. I remember my first impression of all that, going into a club and going, you know, this was far away from home for me. I lived in the safe suburb of Wilmette, Illinois, and all of a sudden I'm on the west side, and there's people hanging out on the street corners with their half pints, and it's a different economic class of people. The
sure.
People were, there's, you know, a lot of poverty in some of the areas. But, you know, I'd walk into this club, the 1815 club, see the Howlin' Wolf, and there's a gravel parking lot that probably had equal parts gravel and broken glass. But as soon as I came in, I found an amazing kindness and acceptance among that particular community. I mean, people are like, hey, how you doing? Let me buy you a beer. You go up and you meet Hubert Sumlin, meet the Howlin' Wolf, hang out with the band. Everybody was just so kind and welcoming. And I go, you know, this isn't how I might have pictured it in the tough west side of Chicago. Because there's just, you know, people are people. Everybody has a basic kindness and a great human spirit. An amazing lesson that I learned, and that was the cool thing about the blues, because it didn't matter if it was Muddy Waters or Howlin' Wolf or Hubert Sumlin, they weren't on a pedestal, they were real people, and they were people that had, you know, an air of leadership and dignity about them, but at the same time, they're real people, and they were happy to greet you, and some would get to know me by my first name and become friends, and it was really a fantastic thing to interact with the true blues guys. You know, I became friends with Lewis Myers, Little Walter's old guitar player. He would share all these stories. At first, I thought I was just that pesky little kid that was asking too many questions, but after years of that, I realized I had developed a really wonderful friendship with the man, and I'm so proud of that.
Hmm. 1815 West Roosevelt from the album Harmonica Blues by our guest Bob Corritor. He's playing harmonica and his friend and one-time Howlin' Wolf sideman Eddie Shaw on saxophone. You're listening to GLT's Talkin' Blues. I'm John Norton. Bob, how did you start playing harmonica?
My brother had a harmonica and actually showed me a couple of the preliminaries, how to bend a note, and it seemed to kind of come natural to me. And so I said, you're pretty good at that. Here, I'm just going to give that to you. And I was, I think, 13 when he gave that to me, and I just played every day since. And I lost a lot of friends in high school, my first years of doing that. I'd play in the back of the bus, wad up their, you know, paper and throw it at me and stuff. But it didn't deter me. I kept going. I had a wonderful group of friends that like to jam, and we would, you know, develop ourselves through all of that. Meanwhile, of course, I'm hearing the blues on the radio. I'm staying in Saturday nights to hear the blues on WNUR. I'm Northwestern University. I'm buying blues records in the stores. I'm just loving it. And here I am in high school. Back then, you know, we'd have a cassette player. I made my own mixtape of, like, Big Walter Horton and Muddy Waters and Jimmy Rogers stuff. And I'm blasting that through the hallways of my high school, and people are looking at me like, what the hell is he playing? And I'm going, this is the coolest stuff right here.
I told you a while back I wanted to get back to your Taboo album. It's one with just your name on the title, because you do so much collaboration with other artists. And this one is, it's just your name on the top. And, you know, you have some different colors and flavors on this album that I really haven't heard on some of your collaborations. Am I hearing that the way you maybe imagined it?
Yeah, Taboo is an album of harmonica instrumentals. That right there might scare you off because you think, well, do we want to hear one long harmonica solo? But I've always loved the art of an instrumental. Little Walter, of course, was so artful, and each of his instrumentals seemed to say something completely different. But now, beyond that, you look at some of the great instrumental sounds of some of the great sax players, some of the organ trios, some of the great sounds that you would hear that would be instrumental. And each of those have a groove, a mood, and a melody that is uniquely within that song. And there's a certain catchiness to each one of those. And it was that art of an instrumental that I was trying to capture in all of this. And so I took the blues, because it's really a blues record, but it takes you to some exotic places. It takes you to some things that you wouldn't expect to hear from somebody who's used to the legacy of the recordings I've played on. Because I play a lot of straight-ahead, down-home blues releases, and there's some of that on here.
Right.
But then there's songs like Taboo, which is a very exotic mood song. It was recorded in Cuba in the 1940s for the first time. It has a very bluesy side to it, but it also has this very exotic thing that goes on. And there were a number of things like that almost seemed like they could have been a soundtrack for a detective movie.
Blues Harmonica of Bob Corator. It's the title track to his latest solo album, Taboo. You can hear more of John Norton's entire conversation with Corator tomorrow night at 7 on 89.1 FM. Corator will perform tonight at the Fluid Events Center in Champaign as part of the 2015 Blues Blast Music Awards.
The GLT Newsroom doesn't work for awards. They work for you.
But WGLT's examination of 90 stops showed...
But along the way, a National Diversity Award, 7 awards from the AP, including Best Writing and Outstanding Downstate News Operation.
They're going to harass you whether you're doing something good or bad.
We have policies that discourage that.
Also for the series Police and Race, 2 National Edward R. Murrow Awards. GLT reporters don't work for awards. They work for you. Hear the award-winning stories at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from the Jack Batal Real Estate Group at Keller Williams, committed to helping you find the right match. Buying or selling your home can be easy. More information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
Still to come is a talk with 2 members of the City of Bloomington Budget Task Force about ways to close the deficit in that city government spending plan. This is Best of Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Our next interview juxtaposes planetary science and healthy outdoor physical activity. Mike McCurdy explains.
From Chicago to St. Louis is a long ways on a bike, but it's no comparison to the vast distances in the galaxy or universe, distances measured in light years. Dr. Lucianne Walkowicz is an astronomer with Chicago's Adler Planetarium and a TED Senior Fellow. She's also in the middle of a 300-mile bike ride designed to bring some perspective to the universe. She's already completed 2 of 7 stops across the state, giving talks about the moon and other satellites in Joliet and near-Earth objects in Dwight, and she speaks at the Normal Public Library about the Kuiper Belt, Oort Cloud, and Pluto. More stops and talks are planned as the galaxy ride continues to St. Louis. Dr. Walkowicz, thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
What are your questions about space or the solar system, the Kepler telescope and its mission, or this science roadshow on a bike? Give us a call at 309-438-8910. Let's start with Pluto, still in the news because of the New Horizons flyby. What caught your attention about this dwarf planet, and what will you tell people at the Normal Public Library about this former planet?
Well, I think we're in a really interesting moment with Pluto because, you know, for many years, the best images that we had of Pluto, the ones taken by the Hubble Space Telescope, it still sort of looked like a mushy pea. So we knew that it was this outer icy body of our solar system, but we really didn't know very much about the planet itself, or the dwarf planet, as we now call it. So what we're seeing with the New Horizons mission is almost like if you had a distant relative that you had never actually seen an image of, and now you're actually able to see their face for the first time. So the surface of Pluto is covered with surprising features, giant icy mountains, signs of geological activity that we expected would have been long since gone on Pluto. And so I think that these images are just the tip of the iceberg in a series of new discoveries about this world.
What do you think is driving that geological activity? Because it's too far from the sun for the heat of the sun to have anything to do with that, probably. So is it magnetic fields? What is it?
Well, usually what drives geological activity in planets and moons is one of 2 things. Either, in the case of our own Earth, we have a molten core that's left over from the heat of our planet forming and also from radioactive decay in its core. And that's what gives us our melty center and what gives us volcanoes. In some of the other worlds in our solar system, Jupiter's moon Io, for example, which is the most volcanically active place in the entire solar system, in Io's case, it's actually being kneaded like a ball of dough by Jupiter's gravity. We call it tidal forces. Now, in Pluto's case, it's really kind of a mystery because Pluto is very, very small. We would expect it to have completely cooled off and not have geological activity anymore. And it doesn't have any way of being tidally kneaded by those gravitational forces. So we're not really sure what causes the geological activity on Pluto. It's still a mystery.
You're also speaking about the Oort cloud tonight. This is hypothetical. It's unobservable, the Oort cloud?
Well, the Oort cloud is not unobservable in the sense that most of the comets we know of come from the Oort cloud. So the Oort cloud, in some sense, comes to visit us in the inner portions of the solar system when we see comets. But it's very difficult to study both that and the Kuiper Belt, the home of Pluto, because all of these worlds are so very cool and they're so very far away. If you were out at that distance, the sun would just look like a particularly bright star in the sky, not like the disk that we see it here on Earth. And so it's very difficult to study things that are so far and so cool.
So your ride is organized, your bicycle ride across the state is organized in a way that makes Chicago the Earth and St. Louis the Andromeda Galaxy, is that right?
That is correct.
So Bloomington Normal is in the area of Pluto and the Oort cloud?
Yes, and we believe that the Oort cloud has quite a large extent, so it goes out to many tens of thousands of AU, but so we're right in the middle of that at the moment. So we're encompassing all of the outer portions of our solar system in this program.
So space is aptly named because there's so much of it. Do you think people understand the vast distances involved in even just between here and Pluto?
You know, sometimes I think I don't even understand the vast distances involved. As an astronomer, you sort of grapple on a day-to-day basis with these issues of scale where we talk about cosmic distance, but we don't really have, as humans, any way of experiencing that. And so one of the most difficult things, I think, to understand is the vast distances between us and even other worlds in our solar system. To give you some sense of perspective, the Voyager spacecrafts were launched in the 70s, and Voyager 2 is the fastest human-made object ever. 38,000 miles per hour it travels. Now, Voyager 2 was launched in the 70s and only really got to the edge of the solar system within the past couple of years. So think about that for a moment. The fastest thing we've ever launched has taken this long to get there. Even the New Horizons mission took 10 years to get to Pluto.
I referenced light years earlier. When you're peering through a telescope, you're actually looking back into time. Tell me about the light you're seeing from some common objects in space and how old that light is.
Well, for example, I kind of like to think about the fact that the light from the sun is 8.5 minutes old. So when we talk about light years, we're really talking about a distance. It's how far light travels in a year. And so our sun is 8 light minutes away, or 150 million kilometers, 93 million miles. So when we look back in time into the depth of space, the nearest stars are maybe a few years old, the light that we receive. Most of the stars that we know planets around, other solar systems, tend to be about 1,000 light years-ish away from us, just by virtue of where we've looked. And then the Andromeda Galaxy, which is actually visible on, some nights if you're in a very dark place. Andromeda is 2.5 million light years away, which I'm very pleased to say I don't have to bike.
So we only know what that galaxy looks like 2.5 million years ago. We don't actually know what it looks like today if you're there.
True. The thing about galaxies is that they evolve over very, very long periods of time, so over billions of years. So a lot of times when people ask me about the time that light takes to travel and looking back in space, there's this notion that, for example, especially with planets around other stars, they say, well, what if that solar system's not there anymore? But the thing is that if you're looking back 1,000 years in time, sure, things might have changed on that planet, but stars evolve over millions and billions of years. And so chances are the thing you're seeing is still there, and it's probably not that different from what you're observing now.
309-438-8910. Dr. Lucianne Walkowicz is an astronomer with Chicago's Adler Planetarium and a TED Senior Fellow. She's also in the middle of a 300-mile bike ride designed to bring some perspective to the universe. You're on the Kepler Space Telescope Working Science Group. Kepler is looking for Earth-like objects. What are you doing as part of this group?
Well, so Kepler launched back in 2009, and its initial mission was to figure out a relatively simple question, which is sort of amazing that we haven't been able to do this until the past couple of years. How common are planets the size of Earth around stars that are like our sun, and specifically around stars like our sun at a distance where they get enough energy from the star that they could be the right temperature to have liquid water on their surface?
Commonly known as the Goldilocks zone?
Goldilocks zone, or the habitable zone.
Sure.
So not too hot, not too cold, just like Goldilocks's porridge. So Kepler essentially looked at this one part of space, this one little patch of the sky about the size of your palm held out at arm's length, just between the constellations of Cygnus and Lyra. And it counted up all the planets that it could find in that part of the sky and used that to extrapolate over how many planets there were in the rest of the galaxy. Now, for my own part of that, I actually work on how stars affect whether planets can be good or bad places for life. So it's not just a matter of how much light you get from the star, but it's also the quality of light. Is it low energy or is it high energy? So I specifically study what are called stellar flares. So many people may have heard of solar flares that happen on our sun. They cause the aurora borealis, for example. And these events happen on other stars as well. And they shower their planets with high energy particles, ultraviolet and X-ray radiation. And that changes the chemistry of the planet that's around them and can also create either hospitable or inhospitable environments for life to exist on those planets.
Dr. Lucianne Walkowicz is an astronomer with the Adler Planetarium and a TED Senior Fellow engaged in a 300-mile bike ride designed to give perspective to planetary science. She spoke with Mike McCurdy. This is Best of Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The city of Bloomington took a significant step toward addressing its $7 million a year structural budget deficit this week.
The Community Budget Task Force has presented its final recommendations to aldermen and the community. Aldermen also took action on one of the funding recommendations in the task force presentation, a 1% sales tax. In the studio are Ward 2 Alderman and Budget Task Force Co-Chair David Sage and Task Force Member John Zunick, who has his fair share of dealing with government budgets as the retired administrator for McLean County. Thanks to both of you for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Thanks for the invitation, Mike.
You can join this conversation at 309-438-8910. What are your questions about proposed cuts? Do the cuts go far enough? Is the sales tax needed, and do you support that sales tax? Give us a call at 309-438-8910. David, a sales tax increase came from the Budget Task Force you co-chaired, but you had some deep concerns about it. You took a long time to push that button last night to vote for it. What were your concerns?
Well, my concerns, Mike, as I shared during our council conversation, were really twofold, is that I thought it was probably more appropriate to have both a vote around potential cuts as well as at the same time a vote on new revenues. That way we bring some accountability into the process. And the other part of it was, and related to it, was that I wasn't comfortable that we had had sufficient time as a full council to really look at the entire situation around cuts and funding. I get worried when things can get isolated and pulled apart, because I think part of our job is to look at the overall picture and make sure that we're seeing every aspect of it.
You went around, actually asked the council, you went around the horseshoe and asked them if they were willing to make cuts in addition to voting for revenue. And here's part of what Alderman Scott Black had to say last night.
And to answer your question, it's a resounding no. I don't think this council has the stomach to genuinely have the cuts conversation. I mean, when we talked about it at the Budget Task Force, I mean, you saw some of the emails that we got, the conversation that we had was spirited. We speak in platitudes and in kind of very vague concepts of what cuts look like. And Alderman Lauer, you know, you're great, principled. You know, I know where you're at, and I appreciate that. And I that's one of my favorite traits about you. One of the challenges is that you have, at any point, an alderman can come up with a budget amendment to make a cut. But the real courage comes in making a coalition of four of your colleagues to convince us to do that. And I'd love to entertain some of your cuts ideas. But the first question this council will then ask is, we'll turn to David and say, what's the impact on staff? And then we will turn to our constituents and say, what's the impact on them? At no point have we ever identified a key program that we are willing to live without. Golf comes up frequently. How many times since I've been on the council, we've talked about it several times, and this nebulous idea of, you know, what could it look like? And then David takes it upon himself to look at Highland Park. You know, I've sat through some of these conversations where I have no idea what the conclusion is. I mean, how does staff know what we're talking about? He looks at Highland Park, and then there's blowback from the public. Well, we don't want to lose our oldest course. You know, we can't do this. And then there's some council, I don't know if I can get behind this. We are just all over the place, left and right. And there's no coalition here that I think would really genuinely look at the major cuts that would have to come from our structural deficit.
Alderman Scott Black from last night's council meeting. David, is he right? Is that an accurate picture?
Well, I think every situation, every conversation is unique, Mike. Hopefully part of what I think was work results, deliverables coming out of the budget task force. And I'll just mention golf, for example, since that's something that Scott mentioned, mm-hmm. is that some of our recommendations are time boxed in the sense that there are a couple of I think, pretty definitive and straightforward acts that we're going to recommend that the council vote on. And we will be voting on all those recommendations here over the next few weeks.
And those will come out as separate resolutions?
Yeah, we're going to vote on them individually. And in that way, we can have give clear direction to staff. But for instance, as it relates to recommendations around, say, again, golf, since that's what Scott brought up, we have time-boxed a couple of very specific recommendations or ideas to see that those are done by the time we adopt the FY17 budget. So what we're trying to do is I think, bring a little bit more structure and form around these potential cuts to help us move forward as a council.
Did Alderman Black's comments give you pause as you decided whether how to vote last night?
Well, I mean, I always sit, and that's one thing I appreciate about our council, right, is we have a lot of interaction, and sometimes those conversations can be difficult. Recently in a planning session, we had one of the aspects we talked about the council was that this idea of it's okay to have a spirited democratic process, right? We think there's goodness in that. We think that's important. The flip side of that is, as I shared at the task force a couple of different times, when you have those conversations publicly, it can be difficult to try to get to consensus. And one thing I appreciate about Scott is it's always his candor and his willingness to engage in parts of conversations that may not always be the easiest parts.
So you think the council has the backbone to actually, if a resolution comes down to says, we're going to close Highland Park, you think the council can get behind that?
Well, I think, again, Mike, It's always going to depend on what's put in front of the
sure,
council.
This is a for instance.
Yeah, I think understanding kind of the full picture. What if that is something that we're going to move forward with, and that's certainly some part of the conversation around golf courses, is then what do we intend to do with it afterwards? What is in this value proposition? If we're going to make a change to Highland, then what lies in the future
sure,
as a benefit?
Golf courses aside, do you think the council has the stomach to actually make some real cuts?
I believe so.
Okay,
I was even more confident of that after our conversation last night.
309-438-8910 in the studio are John Zunick and David Sage, members of the Bloomington Community Task Force. John, let's go to you for a moment. Member of the task force, from that task force came the sales tax recommendations, the same percentage that Normal approved last month. How critical was that sales tax vote last night to trying to help solve some of Bloomington's budget issues, do you think?
Well, I think it's important because one of the things I think the task force was trying to do, and I think they did a good job, is to try and balance the revenue issues along with the expense issues. And clearly, I think Bloomington needed to inject some revenue into the structural deficit. One of the things that's driving that, and again, this is a good example of where you have a state mandate imposed on a local government, and that's the issue of forcing local governments, particularly municipal governments like Bloomington and Normal, to fully fund police and fire pensions. And as a result, there is a significant amount of money that the Bloomington City Council, as a policy decision, set aside and said, we're going to meet 100% funding for police and fire pensions. That's a significant part of their budget. And the sales tax increase potentially gives them some resources to deal with that specific issue. In fact, a number of people on the task force said that if the council is going to look at increasing sales tax, they should look at it and have it be very transparent to the citizens that this money that we're going to generate from this sales tax increase is going to be set aside for police and fire pension.
And are you both supportive of the property tax increase listed in the task force recommendations? Is that something that's going to become necessary, do you think?
Well, I think that'll be part of a follow-on conversation that the council will have about each individual idea coming forward from the budget task force.
Alderman David Sage and former McLean County Administrator John Zunick, members of the City of Bloomington Budget Task Force. The City Council has yet to consider budget cuts in the task force package that could include the sale or outsourcing of a city golf course, a 5% across-the-board spending reduction, downsizing of other services, and fee and service charge increases. Sage and Zunick talked with GLT's Mike McCurdy. Monday, during Sound Ideas, GLT's Jim Brown talks with a scholar visiting Central Illinois who's an expert on 19th century Cuban revolutionary José Martí. You'll hear from Mardra Thomas at her upcoming appearance on Bloomington's Jazz Upfront Lounge. Sound Ideas Monday, made possible by Jack Batal Real Estate Group at Keller Williams, with more at jackknowshomes.com. Everyone in the country music industry recognizes the name of Andrea Zahn. She's backed up singers from George Jones to James Taylor over the last 20 years. The release of her second solo album may widen her fan base. GLT's Bruce Bergathon spoke with a Central Illinois native about her new CD, Rise.
She's one of the most respected session and touring singers and fiddlers in Nashville. But when Andrea Zahn describes her new solo record, she's taken aback by the role reversal it embodies.
It's one thing to be a sideman, and that's my comfort zone, above and beyond just being prepared. You really want to make the artist feel held up so that they're supported and they have the freedom to take chances and to express themselves, and you're dialed in and you've got them, you know, you're there for them. And to be on the receiving end of that with people of that caliber especially was extraordinary. It's amazing.
Zahn's second album as a leader, titled Rise, drops today. It represents a major step forward for the woman who has stood behind James Taylor in his road band for the last 12 years. Zahn has also toured with country icons Lyle Lovett and Vince Gill, as well as the eclectic bluegrass and jazz ensemble of Alison Brown. As friends, Brown and Zahn go back decades to when they crossed paths in the world of instrumental bluegrass contests for fiddlers and banjo players. It was a world also occupied by a very young Alison Krauss, who shares her hometown of Champaign-Urbana with Zahn.
I love Champaign-Urbana. My family is no longer there. You know, I moved to Nashville in 1986. My father was a professor there at the university and spent some years commuting back and forth, but eventually ended up in Nashville permanently. And my mother had moved to Nashville permanently, and my brother. So I don't have family there anymore. I do still have some friends, and, you know, I've made a few excursions.
Do you ever run into that other Allison that is a native of...
The Krauss one?
Uh-huh.
I do. Not as often as I'd like to, because she's arguably one of the busiest people I know. But but we do still stay in close touch, yes.
Allison Krauss may be the only major person from Zahn's past that did not participate in the new recording. Zahn sings duets with Vince Gill, Keb Moe, Mac McAnally, and Trace Adkins, as well as her current employer, James Taylor. The CD had its musical basis in Zahn's decision to record with fellow Taylor bandmate Steve Gadd on drums and the legendary rock and country bassist Willie Weeks. Together, they provided a sympathetic underpinning to a series of compositions that Zahn had been assembling over the decades since her first solo release. The unfortunate illness of her infant son, Leonard, provided a catalyst for her to finish many of the songs.
I'd been writing a little bit, but I hadn't made it a priority, you know, in those interim years. And then as Leonard, when he was 2.5, started exhibiting some symptoms, and we found out that he needed a series of brain surgeries, and he had a lot of complications. And for about 1.5 years, that was without question the priority, was taking care of him and seeing to his wellness, you know. But I found in that time, you sort of observe your life, or you contemplate it and make mental notes. And I try to make mental notes and come away a little wiser in the process. And as humans, we like to put things in boxes we can understand, you know. It's like, oh, that's what happened there, and that's what this moment was about, and that's what I learned there, and that's the observation I had there, you know. I mean, and I think that's where the songwriting comes, is in the reflection. So certainly in that experience, you know, it was unlike other moments in life. It kind of opened up a whole another realm of expression. So yeah, and it felt absolutely like the right thing to do, to kind of reflect on that time and the whole process and put it into song form.
There's a very beautiful picture of you and Leonard in the center of the booklet. Obviously a very special young person.
Well, he's an amazing kid. And that's next to a song about called Let Them Go, about, you know, I think any parent or, you know, someone who loves a child, you know, you see them growing up and it's that bittersweet tug of you try to advise them, but you have to give them the freedom to find their way. And it's that bittersweet loving someone and letting them go all at the same time. So, yeah.
It's the little things that catch your eye. You watch them closer as the years go by. Every bird is born to fly. Let them go. To you, they're always gonna be too young. You always knew the time would come. They're gonna walk, they're gonna run. Let them go.
He's 7 now. Does he have a favorite song on the new release?
Yeah, I put together this little instrumental connective piece. It's like 1 minute long, and it's just this little viola thing for about 1 minute, and we call it the cat song. It's not credited that way on the record, but he said it sounds like our cat jumping around, so that was his favorite one for a while.
Let's talk about some of the taller guys on the record. very nice article about you in Rolling Stone, where you admit to liking to sing with tall, skinny guys.
You know, I didn't set out that way, but it sure has ended up that way. Yeah, absolutely. Tall, skinny guys tend to be really great duet partners, as I found out.
Well, the one with the lowest voice but probably the highest elevation would be Trace Adkins. Can you talk a little bit about that song?
I adore Trace. Yes, Trace sang on a song called Ship, which is has a sort of a Celtic flavor to it. And, you know, Trace is so known for being the consummate country performer. I mean, his stuff is so traditionally country, and he's fantastic at it, and he's got this cavernous, incredible baritone voice that's expressive and resonant and gorgeous. And yeah, he's amazing, actually. I don't know if everybody knows how amazing he is, but he's amazing.
They heard of a life on a new shore, free from the reins of all kings. Of hope all the weary, hope that only the new morning brings.
The duet with James Taylor, who was your current employer, probably was a special moment.
It was, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I've worked with James for 12 years now, and he's one of those rare special breeds of artists who's He's such an incredible interpreter of music, but he's also such a, as we know, he's such a masterful writer and a brilliant guitar player, and his singing is flawless. And you know, I'm still a fan. He was one of my early favorites, you know, as a girl diving into records and sitting in front of the turntable listening to things over and over and over again, as young musicians often do. He was one of the first people to build the record collection, and it just meant the world to me. You know, I asked him if he would consider coming to sing, and he said absolutely, and we got to spend a day in the studio playing around, and it was a tremendous joy.
Anybody else would have just seen pieces laying on the ground, nothing worth keeping. Anybody else would have let me go, but you won't.
No.
Singer Andrea Zahn talking with GLT's Bruce Bergathon. Her CD Rise is released this week on Compass Records. You can also hear James Taylor with her on his latest Before This World. The music of Zahn, Taylor, and many other classic and contemporary songwriters is on GLT's Acousticity, Sundays from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. and 24/7 at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas archives and podcasts, including this episode provided by Mike McCurdy, Bruce Bergathon, John Norton, and Judy Valente. We want to know what you think of the interviews and stories you hear on Sound Ideas. Get in touch at facebook.com, WGLTFM, or tweet your comments using the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org.